Do you think class size, teacher compensation, and school revenue have much to do with education quality? If so, the conclusion is inescapable that we are living in a golden age. From 1955 to 1991, the U.S. pupil-teacher ratio dropped 40%. The average salary of teachers rose 50% in real terms, and the annual expense per pupil, inflation-adjusted, soared 350%. What other hypothesis, then, might fit the strange data I'm about to present? Forget the 10% drop in SAT and achievement test scores the press beats to death with regularity. How do you explain the 37% decline since 1972 in students who score above 600 on the SAT? This is an absolute decline, not a relative one. It is not affected by an increase in unsuitable minds taking the test, or by an increase in the numbers. The absolute body count of smart students is down drastically, with a test not more difficult than yesterday's, but considerably less so. What should be made of a 50% decline among the most rarefied group of test takers, those who score above 750? In 1972, there were 2,817 American students who reached this pinnacle. Only 1,438 did in 1994, when kids took a much easier test. Can a 50% decline occur in 22 years without signaling that some massive leveling in the public school mind is underway? In a real sense, where your own child is concerned, you might best forget scores on these tests entirely as a reliable measure of what they purport to assess. I wouldn't deny that mass movements in these scores in one direction or another indicate something is going on. And since the correlation between success in schooling and success on these tests is close, then significant score shifts are certainly measuring changes in understanding. This is a difficult matter for anyone to sort out, since many desirable occupational categories and desirable university seats even before that are reserved for those who score well. The resultant linkage of adult income with test scores then creates the illusion that these tests are separating cream from milk. But the results are rigged in advance by foreclosing opportunity to those screened out by the test. In a humble illustration, if you only let students with high scores on the language component of the SATs cut hair, eventually it would appear that verbal facility and grooming of tresses had some vital link with each other. Between 1960 and 1998, the non-teaching bureaucracy of public schools grew 500%, but oversight was concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. The 40,520 school districts with elected boards this nation had in 1960 shriveled to 15,000 by 1998. On the college rung of the school ladder, something queer was occurring too. Between 1960 and 1984, the quality of undergraduate education at America's 50 best-known colleges and universities had altered substantially. According to a 1996 report by the National Association of Scholars, these schools stopped providing, quote, broad and rigorous exposure to major areas of knowledge, quote, for the average student, even at decidedly unaverage universities like Yale and Stanford. In 1964, more than half of these institutions required a thesis or comprehensive for the bachelor's degree. By 1993, 12% did. Over the same period, the average number of classroom days fell 16%, and requirements in math, natural science, philosophy, literature, composition, and history almost vanished. Rhetoric, most potent of the active literacies, completely vanished, and a foreign language, once required at 96% of the great colleges, fell to 64%. According to the Journal of the American Medical Association of December 1995, 33% of all patients cannot read and understand instructions on how often to take medication, notices about doctor's appointments, consent forms, labels on prescription bottles, insurance forms, and other simple parts of self-care. They are rendered helpless by the inability to read. Concerning those behind the nation's prison walls, a population that has tripled since 1980, the National Center for Education Statistics stated in a 1996 report that 80% of all prisoners could not interpret a bus schedule, understand a news article or warranty instructions, or read maps, schedules, or payroll forms, nor could they balance a checkbook. 40% could not calculate the cost of a purchase. Once upon a time, we were a new nation that allowed ordinary citizens to learn how to read well and encouraged them to read anything they thought would be useful. Close reading of tough-minded writing is still the best, cheapest, and quickest method known for learning to think for yourself. This invitation to commoners extended by America was the most revolutionary pedagogy of all. Reading, and rigorous discussion of that reading in a way that obliges you to formulate a position and support it against objections, is an operational definition of education in its most fundamental civilized sense. No one can do this very well without learning ways of paying attention, from a knowledge of diction and syntax, figures of speech, etymology, and so on, to a sharp ability to separate the primary from the subordinate, understand allusion, master a range of modes of presentation, test truth, and penetrate beyond the obvious to the profound messages of text. Reading, analysis, and discussion are the way we develop reliable judgment, the principal way we come to penetrate covert movements behind the facade of public appearances. Without the ability to read and argue, we're just geese to be plucked. Just as experience is necessary to understand abstraction, so the reverse is true. Experience can only be mastered by extracting general principles out of the mass of details. In the absence of a perfect universal mentor, books and other texts are the best and cheapest stand-ins, always available to those who know where to look. Watching details of an assembly line or a local election unfold isn't very educational unless you have been led in careful ways to analyze the experience. Reading is the skeleton key for all who lack a personal tutor of quality. Reading touches nothing more important than the state of mind in which you find yourself absolutely alone with the thoughts of another mind. A matchless form of intimate rapport, available only to those with the ability to block out distraction and concentrate. Hence the urgency of reading well, if you read for power. Once you trust yourself to go mind to mind with great intellects, artists, scientists, warriors, and philosophers, you are finally free. In America, before we had forced schooling, an astonishing range of unlikely people knew reading was like Samson's locks, something that could help make them formidable, that could teach them their rights and how to defend those rights, could lead them toward self-determination, free from intimidation by experts. These same unlikely people knew that the power bestowed through reading could give them insight into the ways of the human heart, so they would not be cheated or fooled so easily, and that it could provide an inexhaustible store of useful knowledge, advice on how to do just about anything. By 1812, Pierre DuPont was claiming that barely 4 in 1,000 Americans were unable to read well, and that the young had skill in argumentation thanks to daily debates at the common breakfast table. By 1820, there was even more evidence of Americans' avid reading habits, when 5 million copies of James Fenimore Cooper's complex and elusive novels were sold, along with an equal number of Noah Webster's didactic Speller, to a population of dirt farmers under 20 million in size. In 1835, Richard Cobden announced that there was 6 times as much newspaper reading in the United States as in England. And the census figures of 1840 gave fairly exact evidence that a sensational reading revolution had taken place without any exhortation on the part of public moralists and social workers, but because the common people had the initiative and freedom to learn. In North Carolina, the worst situation of any state surveyed, 8 out of 9 could still read and write. In 1853, Per Siljeström, a Swedish visitor, wrote, "In no country in the world is the taste for reading so diffuse as among the common people in America. The American Almanac observed grandly, quote, periodical publications, especially newspapers, disseminate knowledge throughout all classes of society and exert an amazing influence in forming and giving effect to public opinion," close quote. It noted the existence of over 1,000 newspapers. In this nation of common readers, the spiritual longings of ordinary people shaped the public discourse. Ordinary people who could read, though not privileged by wealth, power, or position, could see through the fraud of social class or the even grander fraud of official expertise. That was the trouble. In his book, The New Illiterates, author Sam Blumenfeld gives us the best introduction to what went wrong with reading in the United States. He also gives us insight as to why learning to read needn't be frustrating or futile. A typical letter from one of his readers boasts of her success in imparting the alphabet code to 4 children under the age of 5 by the simple method of practice with letter sounds. One day she found her 3-year-old working his way through a lesson alone at the kitchen table reading S-M, Sam, M-A-N, man, and so on. Her verdict on the process: "I had just taught him his letter sounds. He picked the rest up and did it himself. That's how simple it is."